Hi, everyone. I'm Karen Hartglass. You are listening to It's All About Food. I'm taking a deep breath here because this is a very important program for me personally. I am here with Jim Mason, and he's the author of An Unnatural Order, The Roots of Our Destruction of Nature. Jim Mason was trained as a lawyer. He was one of the founders and editor of the Animals Agenda magazine and co-author with Peter Singer of Animal Factories in 1980 and The Ethics of What We Eat in 2006. He has written articles for The New York Times, New Scientist, Newsday, Orion, and Audubon magazine, and has contributed to several anthologies, including In Defense of Animals. He lives in Virginia. Before we get started, I wanted to put out a special thanks to Martin Rowe and Lantern Books for continuing to promote this book over the years after it was originally published, I believe in 1993 by Simon & Schuster, and then Martin picked it up and published it, and now it's out for its newest edition under Lantern Books. Welcome, Jim Mason, to It's All About Food.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for having me.
Jim, I read your book probably around 1997. And I was involved with Earth Save International at the time. I think it was at an Earth Save meeting in New York. Maybe you came to speak. I got the book. I even got to speak with you a little bit at some after party. The book made a profound impression on me. Now, I have to say, I've been doing this podcast since 2009. So that's 12 years now, and I've read a lot of books. I'm not one of these sensational interviewers that likes to insult anyone. I'm always finding the positive things about different books, even if it's a book I've read that I don't care very much about. Your book is very different. It is so necessary, so well written for everyone to read. I wish indeed everyone would read it. I wish that this could be the 21st century Bible. And I would give it all the awards that I could. Pulitzer Prize, Nobel Prize. I think everything in this book is the answer. If we want humanity to survive and thrive. We'll get back to that if later. That's my introduction for you. And that's why I'm happy to speak with you. And also, the last few years, I would see your book on the shelf. And I have a lot of books. It was calling to me. It was like telling me, reread this book. And I had remembered a few things about it. I remember how it impressed me. So I had it on my list to reread. But the thing is, especially for this podcast, another thing, I'm always reading books. So there's not a lot of time to go back. So I was so thrilled to find out that there was a new edition. And that gave me the excuse or whatever I needed to read it again. So there we have it. Let's dig into An Unnatural Order, The Roots of Our Destruction of Nature. Can you sum it up a little bit before we get started, or what you had intended when you first wrote this book?
Yeah, Karen, I think the best way to describe it is to say a short story of how I came to write the book. It kind of gets it in a nutshell, and I'll try to be brief and succinct. I just finished Animal Factories, which came out in 1980 with Peter Singer, co-author. During the course of researching and writing that book, I became fascinated, I would say almost obsessed, with the domestic species that we have. How did they become domestic? Cats, dogs, cows, pigs, chickens? Because I'd spent years looking at factory farming and cows, pigs, chickens, and cages. So I thought, I got to look into this further. And a couple of books came across my desk, thanks to friends. Very important one was a book from about 1978, I think, by Paul Shepard. It really kicked my conscience and consciousness a lot. It's Thinking Animals, Animals and the Evolution of Human Intelligence. And basically the pitch in that book, and he's a biologist, this is like heavy duty biology that he's talking about. He says that for the human animal, the human brain, other animals out there, other animals in the world around us were very important to our mind and our consciousness back before we became civilized. The animals had power. They had spiritual power. Hmm. many of the tribal peoples always had, you know, what they called a totem animal, an animal that was the most important. This is the Paleolithic period. And with that kind of mindset about the world around them, animals were the most important others. They were the main other beings in the world, and they were fascinating to human beings who didn't have science yet, didn't know how to explain things. But here were these animals that were fascinating to watch. They'd hear them at night. They would see their antics during the day, and they would be puzzled because animals, oh, they looked different from us. They did a lot of the same things that we did. They ate, they slept, they went pooped and peed and had sex, and they did everything that humans are doing. And we were thinking, to the little extent that we could think in those Paleolithic times, who are they? What are they doing? Who are we? There was this whole dynamic between the human, the budding human mind, and the animals around them. So Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist, the late Joseph Campbell, called this period the way of the animal powers. And this is the way we saw the world before we discovered agriculture. It was a living world. It was live, and it was full of other beings, and they were animated, and they were fascinating. So they loomed large in our cosmology, which is how we see the world. In fact, if you look at the creation stories around the world, not only in tribal societies, but in our own biblical Judeo-Christian society, animals were here first. They were here when the earth was created, and then we came along and they taught us how to live. So no one seems to know and understand how important animals are. And they've been way back in the millions and millions of years of our evolution as a species. So when I discovered that idea, and having been following factory farming and cows, pigs, chickens, et cetera, I had this thought, okay, if animals are so important to the human mind, if they had this mythical power, what happens then when we enslave them and bring them out of their habitat and into our world and turn them into barnyard animals?
Things.
Shackled, penned, yoked, castrated, dehorned. We controlled every aspect of their life, and they didn't, and they lost thanks to us. I didn't say they lost. What was taken away from them was their power. Their power is beings in the wild. So I had to think, what in the world did that do to us? What was the psychic wound in human society and human culture that happened because of this technological breakthrough called agriculture? Now, you know, a lot of people have written about how agriculture changed the world for humans. Mm-hmm. Famous Jared Diamond, the popular writer, said it was, quote, the worst mistake in the history of the human race. I've read a lot of these guys and women who say that agriculture was the thing that changed the world for us. But there's two kinds of agriculture. There's plant agriculture and there's animal agriculture, and the impacts are not exactly equal. Sure, plant agriculture, that is raising wheat, barley, and oats and so forth, caused some changes. It caused people to settle down and stay in one place and live in villages, et cetera, et cetera. But the animal agriculture side of it has much more brutal impacts on the human psyche, because we changed animals from powers to slaves. We changed them from gods to goods. And it had a profound impact on the way we see the world.
And as a result, we have learned to do the same to each other.
Yeah.
Enslave each other and treat each other as things. And we've gone to become a very violent society.
Yeah, it's a shame how many things changed. And some people object to the use of the word slavery. Connection with anything but, you know, whatever black chattel slavery of the American South. But slavery had been around for thousands of years. In fact, our cultural ancestors, the Greeks and the Romans, were built on slavery. And even before that, anthropologists think that the very first human slavery was the enslavement of females, of women. But if you look at the model for that kind of slavery, I'm pretty sure it was animal agriculture and animal domestication, animal husbandry, that provided the model for female slavery, because the warring tribes in those days in the ancient Middle East were animals that were domesticated, which is now part of Iraq, part of Turkey, part of Syria. That was getting to be a crowded part of the world. And when people kept herds in those days, herds of sheep and goats and cattle, they tended to be kind of competitive with each other for water and grassland, because you have to keep those animals supplied with water and grass to keep a healthy herd. They began to make wars with each other, skirmishes, raids, and they would steal each other's cattle, sheep, and goats. It was considered part of the world at that time to raid on a neighboring tribe and take their breeding stock, maybe capture one of the bulls or the cows. Well, when they started having wars between the city-states, they pretty much did the same thing. Sometimes they would neutralize the men so they wouldn't be a threat. They would blind them, they would castrate them, or they would just have mass executions. And this, there are figures given in the Bible of some of the kinds of horrendous cruelty that happened in these wars between the city-states. But they would take the women and the children back to their capital and make slaves out of them. So I always theorized that maybe they learned how to steal women and children the same way they learned to steal animals. Was just take them from your enemies and then use them for your own benefit. So anyway, it's a long road from that period, which we're talking 6,000-8,000 BC, to more modern times, but it's no coincidence that the ancient Greeks and the Romans and the Persians and the Egyptians of all of the classical civilizations were founded on human slavery.
It's hard to really know what happened so long ago, and we can make the most out of the records that we have and the interpretations we have. And you've even spoken about how the interpretation of the information we have was used for so long to support a male-oriented story, myth, perhaps. And you can look at it many different ways, and people are today reinterpreting information to see perhaps we took a different path or different things had originally happened. What I like about the book is that you span a wide range of history and you do it with such a broad overlook of what's going on. And it's easy to understand. I've read other books that try and explain how we got here. And they're very difficult to get through. But a lot of what you're trying to say will shake up the foundation that so many people have about who we are and why we're here.
Yeah.
And a lot of people believe in this hunter-gatherer beginning. Yeah. And how macho men are and were, and the need for meat, and that meat is what made us who we are. There's a lot of theories coming out today that are kind of crashing that whole scenario. But when you're born into a culture that believes something, it's really hard to change it.
Exactly.
Really hard. I know I've been working with food for so long, and just to get people to change what their parents fed them and what their parents told them was right and good,
yeah,
is hard. And I'm thinking about little children today. I've got a lot of friends with young kids and little girls, and they're all growing up as Disney princesses for the first few years of their lives. They all have the same dolls and they're watching the same movies. And what does that do to us?
Yeah.
More myths.
Exactly. Yeah. We're our brain is little by little, slowly and surely getting packed with myths, lies, distortions, etc. The mindset that we have in the book, I call it dominionism, human supremacy. The belief, the grandest myth of all, is that we're not an animal. We're superior. God made us to look like him. It's always a him, right? These ideas are ingrained in every kid. Now, that's in the Western culture. I mean, there are other religions around the world, but we're talking about us here in America primarily. Yeah, I was brought up on that, the Judeo-Christian belief in Jesus and God in the heaven and all of that. I was brought up on that big time, which is interesting because in the book, I found out that cosmology, that view of the world, that creation story that's laid down in Genesis. In the beginning, God created the, all of that. That is the product of the culture of herds people. In our case, it was Hebrews. But the Hebrews were just one of many herdskeeping people in the prehistoric Middle East. And if you read the first few chapters of the Bible, you'll see how the ancient Hebrew tribes were at war with everybody around them, the Ammonites, the Ammonites, the Canaanites, the Hittites. There were so many ites around that part of the world at the time. And they were all herdspeople. They were all keepers of cattle and sheep and goats. And they all had similar stories, but the Hebrews just happened to be better writers than everybody else. They knew how to read and write. They put it all down. Well, now we've inherited that worldview of these ancient sheep and goat herds people. And according to the anthropology I've been reading, and I actually did look up a lot of scientific sources for the book, it's not all theory spun out of thin air. Anthropologists are saying that this is where the idea of monotheism comes from. The idea of one powerful God in heaven, the idea for that emerged primarily in the people who kept flocks, the herds of sheep and goats, because they began to identify with the model that they lived in, which was the gentle shepherd caring for the flock, guiding it to pasture. Look at the Bible, look at the verses in the Bible that talk about shepherds and the Lord is my shepherd. He makes me lie down in green pastures and leads me to water. This is all shepherd mythology, and it's part of the Bible for us. So the worldview that we've inherited comes, according to the anthropologist I've been reading and cited in the book, comes from the people who kept herds. They invented the idea of one all-powerful God, and we are the sheep, and he is the shepherd. And if you look at some of the symbolism in religious life. What is the symbol that the bishop carries when he's in the cathedral? It's a shepherd's staff, isn't it? That's the symbol of Christian, Catholic Church has the shepherd's staff. So much symbolism comes from the herdskeeping tradition. So this is the worldview that we inherited. And I'm gonna add one more thing. I'm getting kind of windy here, but one of the most important things that happened when we enslaved animals and brought them under our control is we broke that primal sense of kinship that we had with other animals. They were so much like us. They were so important to our tribe in 25,000 BC that we considered them sort of part of the extended family. And in some of the mythology that survived of the people of that time, they did believe that some of these animals might have been ancestors of the tribe. They were the special animals that taught them how to live in the world. They were very important to them culturally. So when we enslave these animals, guess what happens to that sense of the world, that sense of kinship? It gets blown up because now we don't want to be kinship with the animals that are in our barnyard that we're slaughtering and putting under the yoke. So it broke what I call in the book, the primal bonds of kinship with other animals, where in a time when we actually felt comfortable in the world, we felt at peace in the world because we weren't alone. We weren't like a single solitary special animal, not an animal, a special being over everything else. Now we're lonely, now we're alienated. Back then we actually felt part of the world, bonded with the world in a sense of kinship. All that's been lost.
I was raised Jewish. My parents weren't very religious. When I was young, like maybe 7 or 8, I wanted to go to Hebrew school. I was somebody that if I was going to follow something, I wanted to do it right. I wanted to know all the rules. I wanted to understand them. I was an all or nothing kind of person. I still am. And so I went to school and I learned. There was a lot that didn't make sense to me. Hebrew school was the first place I discovered discrimination against me. I was one of the best students, but I didn't get all the honors because I wasn't a boy. Mm-hmm. That didn't make sense to me. How is it that those guys can miss class and go to baseball practice or something and they still get all the perks? It didn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
But they taught us that as Jews, we were the chosen ones. And we were given this special identity.
Yeah.
And we were taught that these pagans, these people that came before the Hebrews, would worship these idols, these stone idols. And they interpreted it in such a way that was so arrogant and so superior. And reading your book and others, I realized that there was so much missing from that story. The worshiping these idols, they were representations of this mass power that animal species and the whole earth had.
Absolutely.
And a respect.
Yeah. Remember when Moses came down from the mountain? Moses went up the mountain and God handed him the Ten Commandments, and he came down the mountain. He was really pissed off when he saw his people down there worshiping the golden calf. Remember that scene?
Yeah, absolutely.
They were doing the rituals down there that were the predecessors of the monotheist belief, which is those people worshiped or adored many different kinds of gods, which, as you point out, are symbolized usually in animal form, the golden calf, maybe others. And sometimes it was a ram, a great bull was the symbol of the people, because that was the emblem of their totem animal, their special animal. Moses didn't like that at all, did he?
No, and we were given interpretations of all of these stories to take us in a certain direction. And one more thing I remember is we were taught that the Jewish religion was the first to identify humans as individuals.
Uh-huh.
And this was an important thing. We were all unique. We were all individuals. We could all be in charge of our own destiny. And as a result, now I'm looking backwards, we lost our connection to each other, to animals, to the world. And all of these things that I was taught that were special were really leading us to our demise.
Yeah, this is an alienating worldview. And unfortunately, it spread way beyond the Hebrews to the Christians and then the Muslims. They have the same creation story, monotheism, humans are special, humans are unique, human supremacy and exceptionalism. We are not part of this living world. We are so special. No other animal gets to go to heaven. That was a big scene for me in Sunday school, the Methodist Church, circa 1952 or something. I had my favorite dog had died, Butch. And I go to Sunday school and I ask the preacher if I'm going to see Butch in heaven. Oh my God, you could have heard a pin drop. No, he was sorry to say Butch won't be in heaven. Animals don't have souls. Boy, that was it for me.
Yeah.
Couldn't wait to get out of there.
Yeah, because Butch had a soul and you knew it.
I think I became an atheist from that moment. Because I knew some of the so-called souls in the church, the backsliders and the hypocrites and the people who are cheating on their wives and everything. And I thought, wow, every animal I know has more soul than some of the people in this church. So yeah, I was brought up on that.
There are a number of things you talk about, these animal qualities, these animal characteristics that animals have, and humans as animals have them as well. And these are the things that we want to separate ourselves from or kind of control. And our sexuality is a part of that. And I thought it was interesting how you talked about how foragers, the women knew not to have children as often, maybe every 3 or 4 years instead of every year or whenever. They had a certain control of it because it was inconvenient to carry a baby along with you to wherever you were moving to find food and find fresh resources. And then as we learned to settle in our agricultural communities, we could have more children because we needed more of a workforce and we weren't going anywhere. And then through religion and other means, we learned to dislike our sexuality and not embrace it as natural and try and find a way to control it because it wasn't attractive. It wasn't human.
It was necessary evil.
A necessary evil. And then we made it dirty.
Yeah.
And now we're all a mess because we can't embrace our sexuality.
Especially non-procreative sexuality. that's homosexuality, masturbation, so-called unnatural sex has been a crime punishable by some serious penalties right up until a few decades ago in most states. Yes, if you're gonna have sex, you're supposed to create a baby. I don't know if you remember some of those passages in the book where I quoted, I think it was St. Augustine, who was a, you know, one of the philosophers of the Catholic Church. And he said that sex, even in marriage, was a bad thing. It happened very carefully and only at night. And only with the thought of having a baby. You can't have lust. That's like being an animal. That's when we're out of control and we lower ourselves to the animal level. Then there's that scene I mentioned, Cotton Mather, the eminent New England preacher, was taking a pee and he noticed that his dog next to him was doing the same thing. And he was horrified because it reminded him, oh my God, I'm an animal. And he was so ashamed. He says, think of how we despise the animal within ourselves and they deny that we're animals. Hello, we're mammals.
Yes.
Get at it.
We've really taken, was it one turn or a series of turns? Well, whatever we did, we turned to the dark side.
Exactly.
And we are paying the price. It amuses me, someone looking at themselves urinating and thinking it's a terrible thing. In our home, we're both vegans, my partner Gary and I, and we celebrate moving our bowels every day.
Good.
We celebrate it. I mean, I know a lot of people struggle with constipation because of their diet, and it's just a beautiful process, and it's something to celebrate.
Absolutely. No shame, no shame in being an animal.
No, I'm just wondering. So your book first came out in 1993. There have been several versions of it since then. The religious community, did you get any feedback from them from reading your book?
Well, not what you'd expect. I did hear from some religious people, but they were kind of unusual in that they're pro-animal religious people. Some of them supported some of the ideas in the book. Some of them are sort of uncomfortable, especially when I talk about the invention of God by shepherds. I mean, that's pretty blasphemous when you think about it. The ones that did engage me about it were fairly tolerant and curious about these ideas. So I was lucky in that regard. One fairly devout person told me when he saw the book, he said, wow, this is a radical book. Yeah, it is. Radical comes from Latin for the root of things, as in radish, you know. So yeah, I want to be radical because I want to get to the root of this worldview that we're now saying, say that we're enjoying it, and it's maybe questionable. The worldview that we have of human supremacy and exceptionalism, of dominion over the living world, is not working for us. It's producing climate change. There's going to be disaster. It's not just the disaster of the days being hotter. The climate change is going to cause massive dislocations in how we grow food, where we grow it, the people who do the work, they're going to be dislocated. Like, we're already seeing trouble around the world with massive dislocations of people migrating from one place to another. There's going to be a lot more of that if we don't get a hold of this.
It's important to note that you expressly did not write about climate change or the details of animal agriculture and its impact and cruelty, and also its impact on our health by consuming them.
Yeah.
This was a different story. It's why it touched me so deeply, because it really explained how we got here.
How we got to think this way.
How we got to think this way, and how we got to accept everything that we accept today as natural. As natural.
Yeah.
As you call your book, an unnatural order. We're accepting so many things as natural. When I first read your book, it resonated so much with things that I thought of intuitively, but I could never put them into words. And you did that for me. So thank you.
Thank you.
Which is why I wanted to read it again. Now, I have to ask you a question, because there was something that I remember and I attributed it to you, but I didn't see it in the book. So I wonder, did you really write it, or did I hear you say it, or maybe somebody else said it? But this was about agriculture and how learning how to grow food enabled us to feed people. And the concept behind it is that we keep people from starving, mm-hmm. and we're able to grow more and more food, and we make more and more people, and we have more and more people that are hungry. So now we have 8 billion people on the planet, and we have about 1 billion people that are starving or food insecure. Mm-hmm. And so agriculture didn't solve that problem. Absolutely. Were you the one who said that? Was that in your original book?
I might have said something to that effect in a talk at some point. Yeah, there's the irony in that when the world began to get crowded back in the ancient Middle East, the prehistoric Middle East, 7,000-8,000 BC, they wanted to expand the food supply as best they could because foraging was becoming less and less an option because of this increasingly crowded place. You got to where to forage the way you used to, you'd run into too many rival groups foraging. So they had to kind of stay in place and make do with what they could find right around them. And in that process, they learned how to grow things, to cultivate, to turn some wild grasses into productive barley and wheat. And the same with the sheep and goats. They learned to control them enough to increase the numbers. Well, I thought about it. That was a great technological development to figure out how to feed more people. And in hindsight, now I think, wouldn't it have been better if the technological development had been better birth control? So instead of trying to feed more people and have more people, we have kept the numbers down and we wouldn't have been so crowded and so competing with each other for sources of food and water, which we are now. I mean, we almost have an overrun planet. Yeah. So yeah, I think I might have said something like that. And I did a lot of other writings that kind of spun off parts of the book. So you might have seen a piece of that thinking somewhere else that why didn't we, instead of feeding more people, figure out how to control birth like we were doing in our animals?
Yeah, we thought about doing it for animals.
Yes. Yeah, we wanted to control the breeding of our, I like the word, livestock.
Yeah.
They're livestock.
Yeah, they're things.
Yeah.
They're things. I personally made a choice when I was a teenager not to have children because I recognized the population problem and I didn't have this drive, this feeling of need to procreate. Of course, that went against all the messages I was getting from my religious upbringing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Something that I found personally that resonates with me right now, we're house sitting at a friend's home in California and she's got this great garden in the backyard with fruit trees and herbs. And anytime I'm in a natural space, a natural environment that is lush and bursting with food, I feel at home and I feel celebratory. Oh, look, there's all these wonderful sweet things for me to eat. And I love the abundance of it. It's just a wonderful feeling. And I think, is that something that's in my DNA?
Yeah.
When I was growing up, we moved to a new house that hadn't been developed yet. As I grew up, the open area behind us became more houses, but there were lots of wild blackberries. And I used to just go on my own. My parents didn't know where I was going. I was like, 10, 12, and I would find all these berries. And I was just like, I'm a millionaire. I'm surrounded by all these berries. And I would just eat them. I'd bring them home. I tried to make jam out of them, but they got really hard. I didn't know what I needed to do about that, but just seemed like a paradise.
Yeah.
Free food. That was delicious.
Yeah. And the sensory experience of it too. You smell, hear, feel, see so many more things in the world around you that are alive, just like you. You can hear the crickets at night. You can hear the coyotes yelping at each other. You hear so much out there in the world around you, you don't feel alone. You feel like, hey, I'm a part of this.
Now back to this myth that we've been made to believe, this herder's myth and our treatment of animals and taking away their magic and making them things that we can exploit and abuse. And then we learn how to do it to other people. Fast forward to 2021, we all have this feeling of superiority over other people that other people aren't as smart, aren't as good. We know the history of the United States, where we stole the land from the Native Americans and lied to them, broke treaties, all kinds of lovely things, gave them disease. And then we shipped the Africans over to grow our food, build our buildings, and religion and some secular philosophies made us believe that these people were inferior and that gave us the right to abuse them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I spent quite a bit of time in a book in one chapter examining how this hatred of animals, I call it misothory, kind of a bad word to dream up something as clumsy as that. But I could find no word in the English language for this attitude of contempt that we have toward other beings, other animals, as inferior, possibly dangerous, possibly wicked. Look at the way that Satan, the devil, is symbolized. He's part animal. He has horns. He has claws. He has a tail. Satan is almost part animal. So animals are pretty much despised because they're under us and they're the ultimate other. So this plays into how we regarded other people when we encountered them around 1500, when Columbus and the others began to explore, to discover other continents. And what were they supposed to think when they see people, human beings out there living in the wilderness? By the way, the word wilderness is from Old English. It means place of the wild beasts. Wild deor ness, place of the wild beasts. When we went to the wilderness of America or Africa and we saw human beings, they didn't look like us. They were living in a very different way from us. They had very strange customs and habits. Well, of course, they were going to be regarded as animals. And when they first encountered Native Americans, the indigenous people of the Americas and the islands in the Caribbean, they had a big fight back in Spain over whether they were animals or whether they were just subhumans. There was a big debate about this. It went on for decades because some of the explorers thought they were just animals and they could be killed because they were killing each other and eating each other. Some of them are cannibals. So it wasn't thought that they were human. Then, you know, the progressives for the time, and get this, the progressives said, oh no, they're subhuman. They might have souls. So we got to go carefully here. And that was the way they encountered the indigenous peoples of the Americas. And same thing when they encountered Africans, because Africans looked very different. They were a different color. They had different customs, different foods, different things. So of course they would be regarded as not completely human beings like us. So these are the building blocks of what the racism that we are living with today. And the roots of it go deep. The roots of it go right back to the idea that we're special, we're supreme, we're exceptional. And we're talking about white people, actually, Christians, Europeans, better than all the others out there. Animals are the original other, but there are a lot of sort of humanoid people who are other too. They're not like us and we're better than they are. Oh, we have delusions of grandeur when it comes to our sense of supremacy. We extend it far and wide. We're better than everybody else. I remember when I was a kid, our town was better than the neighboring town. We were from Mount Vernon and those people from Pierce City were like underlings. They weren't, they couldn't read and write like we did. We just love this idea that we're so special.
Do humans need to have this identity, or is it something that we've been taught that we need?
I think it's taught. And I think if we would go back to the views of the pre-agricultural people, like it's a big fad on the Paleolithic diet, you know, it's been the several years. It's not the Paleolithic food groups that we should be looking at. It's the Paleolithic cosmology, the Paleolithic worldview that we should be looking at, how they saw the world as alive, full of kindred beings. Beings out there that were, some of them are more powerful than us. So we couldn't feel superior and supreme and dominating everything because we were part of that web of life. That's the Paleolithic attitude that we ought to try to recover. And I don't mean all of its superstitions. The people were superstitious. They believed in crazy, miraculous, mythical stuff that actually doesn't hold up to science. But science tells us that, biology tells us that, yes, indeed, we're very closely kin with other animals, specifically chimpanzees. What is the figure? 98% of our DNA is identical to the chimpanzee. We have biological proof of our kinship with other beings. Our blood types and our blood parts are the same in mammals. We have the same organ systems.
Well, it seems okay to drink their baby's milk.
Yeah, well, that's proof of mammals.
Yeah.
So there's so much proof of biological kinship. So there's no need to resort to the superstitions of the Paleolithic period. But the mindset that they had bonded them with the living world. They felt a part of it. They felt comfortable. They felt like they belonged on the earth, not like us. We're alienated. We'd like to get out of this place. We want to establish colonies on Mars. We want to destroy the earth and go somewhere else and start all over again. Come on.
You mentioned in the book, there are so many things, and I'm not really highlighting them. We're just touching on things, but I think it was in the agricultural chapter. You talked about some comparative studies of bones that have shown that foragers had better health than farmers.
Yeah.
And we have so many notions about who we are and how much better we are now than before.
Yeah.
But there's some evidence that, well, especially now, it's hard to say because our health is kind of going down now too with all these chronic diseases, and there are predictions that future generations aren't going to fare as well. But evidence that some 30,000 years ago, we were in better shape than yeah. farmers of subsequent generations.
Yeah, true. They had the forager people had a more varied diet. They ate lots of different kinds of things and not always animals. If you read a lot of the contemporary literature, you think that they lived exclusively on hunting and eating meat. When they've looked at contemporary forager societies that are similar to the ones of the past, 90% of their diet was plant-based. Hunting was not always that successful, and they didn't go out every day and kill, you know, a bison or a deer or some large animal. That would be maybe once every year or two, they would get something like that.
Mm.
One anthropologist said, and when they did, they never stopped talking about it. They were so proud of themselves. But no, the forager diet was varied. They ate foods seasonally because, you know, fruit doesn't grow on trees year round. So when it was a fruit season, they would live off of what they could collect in the area, in their eco niche, in their hunting grounds, we'd call it, or foraging grounds. But when they became farmers, agriculturalists, they started living off of monocultures, grains, wheat, yeah, and they just didn't have the variety that they did before, because foraging, as I said, was no longer an option because the area was, the space, the geography was full of people, and foraging was less and less possible. So they had to raise their own food, and they tended to stick to one or two crops, and they'd live off of gruel, off of like boiled grains a lot. So they were more vulnerable in the first centuries of agriculture until they perfected lots of different kinds of crops. It was kind of slow going at first. There's a great book on it called Health and the Rise of Civilization. And all of the books I've read on it show that human diet and health took a dive when we went from foraging to farming.
It's funny because now with our great knowledge and science, we are discovering that humans fare better on a diet of diversity.
Yeah, at long last.
Something that we knew intuitively through nature.
More fruits and vegetables, plant-based foods will keep you healthy.
So here we are, 2021. A few things I wanted to get to. There are how many wars going on around the globe?
Oh, it's absurd.
It's absurd. And
absurd.
Somebody recently was talking to me about this new battle between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and everybody's taking sides, and they wanted to know my opinion. And basically, what I wanted to say was read Jim Mason's book, Unnatural Order. We have to go way, way back to understand why we're here today.
Yeah, we're a warmongering culture. Every little nickel dime nation has to have a standing army, you know, Nicaragua, you know, or some developing nation. They all have to have an army and they have to have weapons. They want to buy tanks. They want to buy fighter planes. And guess what? We've got the US, UK, France, Russia, China. We got dozens of very wealthy countries that will make airplanes and guns and bombs and sell them to these people so they can be protected. The whole world is arming itself in the, you know, in some frenzy that we're all going to have to fight each other off. I mean, what's it come to? 5,000 years of civilization and human history, and we can't do better than this? I mean, what are we? Are we superior or not?
Another topic I'm glad you touched on in the book is companion animals, pets, and breeding.
Yeah.
There are so many things that bug me about humanity and our habits, but this is one that really gets to me. I have a lot of dear friends who love their pets, their companion animals, their children, they like to call them, and they don't really see what they're doing.
Yeah, I know. When the thing that appalls me the most is what I call bred in cruelty. We are so obsessed with the shape of the dog. We want it big and tall. We want it short and fat. We want restructured the dog who is a descendant of the wolf. They have the same DNA as wolves in the wild. But we've been shaped. The first domestic animal was the dog. It joined us because our campsites tended to have leftover food around. So the wolves basically would come to the forager group and kind of follow them around and eat the leftovers, so to speak. And little by little, they became acclimated to that group of people, that extended family. And they became almost like pets 20,000 years ago. Yeah, we love our dogs, but gosh, what a shame what we've done to them, how we've changed their anatomy so that they suffer. So like my partner has a dachshund. It's kind of a hybrid dachshund. It somewhere back there, it interbred with a black lab. So we've got we've got this oversized little dachshund. And the poor little guy, his joints, his legs, he's born to be crippled because of the way he was shaped. And people still insist on these shapes, these looks in their dogs. The healthiest dog is the mutt, the mixed breed that looks more like the original dog.
We have gotten ourselves to this strange place where we need to be with animals. We need their magical energy. We need their unconditional love. But we've twisted and distorted it into something, there's no word for it, except your word.
There's science on this need for companion animals. They found that people who are suffering, all different kinds of suffering, they've tried it with people who have psychological problems, like in prison, or vets who have been wounded and are recovering. When they bring a companion animal to them, somehow they want to live and they want to heal and they want to get better.
Right. But instead we want them to jump through hoops and over fire and do tricks for us and
amuse us
and be our playthings and wear little outfits and bring home medals.
As in the circus, when we make elephants dress up in silly costumes and dance.
Yeah.
But that's an example of proving our dominion, our mastery. Oh my God, we could make this huge 3-ton beast do tricks. Aren't we powerful?
And in your book, which covers a long span of time, we get up to current time. We're still doing horrific things. We have all kinds of crazy rituals, rodeos, and the circuses. Fortunately, we're voting to keep animals out of circuses, more and more wild animals. There are some positive things happening.
Yes.
Now, you wrote your book originally in 1993. It's been 27 years.
Yeah.
A lot's happened. Do you see positive change, hope, a way out or a way around?
Yeah, you have to see. If you're paying attention at all, there's a pretty good shift in attitudes about other animals, wildlife, we call them. You know, that's animals that we haven't taken control of yet. We're really concerned that there are more tigers in captivity in backyards in the United States than there are in the natural habitat of tigers in Asia. Mm-hmm. And people are a little more aware of that and more concerned about that. The people who kept elephants, pretty much being phased out of zoos and menageries and circuses. We now know so much about the behavior of elephants, about their sense of family bonding. You know, the herd is typically a bunch of females, mothers, and their calves, their juveniles, their babies. And the males sort of live separately. It was probably a good system. But anyway, we're learning so much more about the life of elephants and the way they actually communicate with each other. They have a language of sorts. We wouldn't call it language in the sense of Shakespearean English, but they do communicate and they tell each other things. So we're learning so much about that through science, again, that we're beginning, and I'd say we're past the beginning, we're well into some respect for the qualities of life that we've learned about in elephants, that the way they live and the quality of life they have is worthy of our respect. We don't treat them like a thing like we might have 100 years ago. Now we're seeing them as animals much like us that have families, that care for their young, that protect each other. It's not a rocket science here. It's easy to see it if you just look. So yeah, we're seeing some changes.
You coined the word, you mentioned it before. I don't know that I'm pronouncing it right. Misotery?
Misotery rhymes with misogyny.
Misogyny, misotery. Misotery.
Yes, misotery means contempt for animals.
Misotery, misogyny, and I'm thinking of misanthrope. How do you say that in that form?
Misanthropy.
Misanthropy.
Misanthropy. It's kind of a contempt for human beings, kind of a human haters.
I have a little bit of misanthropy. Do you think we deserve to continue and find a better way?
Yeah, we do. It's our culture is the villain here. The human species is just another ape, an animal, a mammal. And we just got a lot of wrong ideas, you know. We got a lot of wrong ideas about our place in the world. We got a wrong, huge, the biggest lie, talk about the Trump, but the big lie is that we're supreme, that we're the superior exceptional creature, not animal, over everything else. And the God who looks like us has given us a blank check. Here's a license to rape, rob, and steal from the planet. Everything is here for you. What is it? Multiply and replenish the earth. Go forth and multiply and replenish the earth. And the beast and every living thing shall be food for you. And there's so much in Genesis about God giving us like complete permission to do whatever we want. We own it all, and he's given us the license to do whatever we want. That's the big lie. I'm sorry, but it's blasphemy to some to say that. But having been religious, you know, in the early part of my life, I had to give it up because I discovered that big lie, that there's no God to give us permission to these terrible things and to destroy the climate and the living planet. That's not a God that I want to worship.
Well, Jim, thank you for being courageous to do that. Because like I said earlier, when we started talking, it takes a lot of courage to recognize that the foundation you've been grown into is a myth and isn't really there. And that the ground below you is crumbling because there's no truth to it. Takes a lot of courage to recognize that and to figure out where you're going to stand.
Well, I appreciate your support for the book. And I thank you so much for having me do this chance to reach an
audience.
You're
welcome. I'm going to work hard to get a lot of people to read it.
Thank you.
I think the only way we can solve our problems is to understand how they started. And this is it.
That's it. We've got to look at the roots of our destruction of nature because it's a pressing issue now with climate change. You know, fossil fuels poured carbon into the atmosphere, but that's not the ultimate cause. The cause is this belief in our being so special that we can do anything we want, that it's all ours, it's our property. So that is the basic cause of climate change. Our very worldview, our cosmology itself, is creating the destruction of the living world, which some people call nature. I prefer the living world. That's what it really is.
Jim Mason, author of An Unnatural Order, The Roots of Our Destruction of Nature. Thank you so much. You have no idea how much joy it is for me to talk with you.
Thank you, Karen.
Okay, be well. I hope you live long and prosper. Okay, you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for joining me, everyone, for another episode of It's All About Food. Your assignment is to get this book, The Unnatural Order. Read it and share it with everyone. And that's another episode of It's All About Food. You can find more information at responsibleeatingandliving.com, where I live. Comments and questions are always welcome from you. Send them to info@realmeals.org. Have a delicious week, everyone.